Hello, this is Dean Kernut, and welcome to the Alpha Exchange, where we explore topics in financial markets associated with managing risk, generating return, and the deployment of capital in the alternative investment industry. Over more than two decades in markets, John Mark Piampiano has traded his share of volatility, managing derivative portfolios over the years from both the long side and the short side of the carry ledger. And across the spectrum of listed and OTC products, John Mark is a keen observer of change in market structure, trading technology, and the provision of liquidity. Our discussion considers the manner in which price discovery in equity option markets has evolved, now well represented on the screens through pricing engines that are entirely automated. In this context, we explore the implications of much tighter screen bid offers for the buy side and sell side alike. Gone are the days where obvious pricing dislocations come about from concentrated option buying or selling in one name and one part of the vol surface. The result, a greater degree of market efficiency and increased importance on trading technology to find and implement trades that capitalize on smaller relative pricing discrepancies. We talk as well about running a tail risk program and the challenges that come from carrying protection during very quiet periods. Noting the increased tendency for market vol regimes to transition very quickly, John Mark shares his thoughts on how investors should think about hedging, emphasizing the need to have an action plan to monetize premium expansion during a market sell-off. Please enjoy this episode of the Alpha Exchange, my conversation with John Mark Piampiano. My guest today on the Alpha Exchange is John Mark Piampiano. He's the founder and CIO of Engineered Portfolios and a prop trader in all kinds of derivatives. John Mark, it's great to connect today, and thanks for being a guest.
Thanks for having me, Dean. It's good to have a good chat.
Yeah, we've known each other for quite some time. We've interacted and put up a couple of prints along the way in listeds and OTC and high vol regimes, low vol regimes. So you've been at this quite a while. And so I'm really eager to get your take on a lot of the change that we're seeing across the spectrum of derivatives markets. Give us a sense as to how you got started in the industry. I know it's a bit ago, but always good to start with the early days of your career. I'd love to learn more about that.
I started out originally in the energy derivatives market. I worked for a company called Hess Energy Trading, which was essentially like an energy hedge fund lodged within Amerada Hess. We did all sorts of arbitrage trades in energy space, in addition to just speculating on the direction of certain energy markets. So that was sort of my original foray into derivatives. But I fairly quickly shifted over to the equity side, actually right around the time when electronic option trading became more prevalent. I was actually one of the original specialists on the ISE, International Securities Exchange, back when they were trying to become the first all-electronic options exchange. So it was really the early days of electronic market making and electronic trading. And I really got to see the rise of electronic trading from the front lines, so to speak.
I'm remembering back when the ISE first launched, and it was a big deal just in the, as early as 2002. I mean, if you went to actually lift some liquidity off of one of the exchanges, there was almost a guaranteed fade based on what was on the screen. So nothing was guaranteed at the time. And of course, now electronic trading is just prevalent across every options exchange. So you've got a lot of perspective. You've done your fair share of market making and prop trading on the buy side. You've been in positions on the sell side as well. So you've had a chance to really see the evolution of markets in derivatives over many years. Why don't we just start with your kind of big picture perspectives on some of those critical changes from your early days to now? So let's not focus on geopolitics or risk cycles or the Federal Reserve, but just the structure of the markets, the microstructure, so to speak. Why don't you give us your big picture perspective on some of the things that you see as really important?
You alluded to this in your preface. There's really been a wholesale transformation of the market microstructure, especially on the listed options and listed derivative side generally. Back in the early days of the option market, well, hypothetically, they showed screen prices, as you point out, really it was more of a block trading world. When you wanted to transact, you would call down to the floor. The floor market makers collectively would make a market. There would be some negotiation back and forth, and either something would trade or not trade. But it was slow. It tended to be very sort of block trade oriented. And there were a huge number of people involved. When I started in the option market, some of the single stock pits in the CBOE had 40 people in them or more. That was the kind of manpower that was in there. In many cases, the guys in those pits were trading four stocks or options on four stocks. In some ways, when I started market making on the ISE, that was sort of the beginning of the end of that regime. And when you fast forward to today, if you look at these big upstairs, high frequency market makers, the guys who are actually really making the kind of risk decisions in something, for example, like a large block of equities or equity options, it's one guy watching 200 stocks now instead of 50 people trading four stocks. So really, we've seen technology just totally transform that market and transform the way capital is deployed. So it's been quite a shift.
Just thinking back to the early 2000s, of course, we had just a fascinating period in technology stocks of incredible fervor and lofty valuations, to say the least. This period, probably over the course of maybe 18 months or so, of stocks up and vol up as well. That was a pretty interesting time period. And back then, you had periods where there would be actual dislocations in vol surface. Someone comes about to do something. There's a huge and ongoing overrider in upside calls, let's say in Intel. And they push it down enough. And at some point, it just sets up cheap versus a lot of other things. I remember the Paul Allen collar, again, back at the same time period, where the skew in Microsoft was just so elevated as a result of the risk-taking or the risk-sharing that was going on in the back of that collar. Walk us through how that looks now, not obviously specific to Intel and Microsoft, but take us through just the way in which risk is priced then versus now. What are some of the key observations in terms of how these vol surfaces come to be, how they move around?
There are lots of moving parts to it, but I'll start on what's happening on the liquidity provider side and then move to what's happening on the option user side, in the sense of people that are trading them either in overwriting strategies or in hedging strategies or that type of thing. On the liquidity provider side, as I mentioned, there's just been this massive concentration of liquidity providers. You went from, in 2000, as an example, every single bank essentially had a market-making desk. On the floors themselves, there were hundreds of market makers and multiple floors with lots of market makers. It was really a very diffuse market in terms of where the liquidity was coming from. When you look at the market today, it's extremely concentrated. If you look at the options that are traded in the U.S., the top five market-making firms are accounting for the lion's share of the liquidity in the market. So it's a very, very narrow market. And actually, if you look at the amount of capital that's supporting that the liquidity that's being provided, it's much smaller than it was in 2000, much, much smaller, where you used to have these huge bank balance sheets that were providing liquidity under some circumstances. That, for the most part, is gone at this point. And you have really a handful of specialty firms that only do high frequency market making, or in some cases more like high touch market making, but they've basically used technology to become so efficient that they don't have to carry the same sort of capital base to be able to make markets in lots and lots of different things. So narrower concentration of liquidity on the liquidity provider side. That's the first thing. The second thing is that where previously I would call the option market a little bit more two-way, in the sense that you certainly had some portfolio hedgers, but the example of the tech bubble is a very good one, in the sense that you had lots of people who were buying calls on stocks, just as speculators, hoping that they were going up. So it was a little bit more of what I would call a balanced market. And I know when I was a market maker during that period, rather than being sort of some sort of systematic seller premium or systematic buyer premium, we tended to be sort of range traders of volatility, sort of as the overlay strategy for the market making book. When vol got pretty cheap, because like a call overrider came in, you turn around and buy that with the idea that you're either going to spread it against something shorter dated, or in some cases simply warehouse that vega or that optionality until you can liquidate it at a more attractive price when things start to move around more. Whereas I think as we saw this onset of automated market making, really, and actually automated strategies on the end user side, whether it's completely automated overwriting strategies or completely automated premium selling strategies or completely automated hedging strategies in the case of some of these indices, I think those have tended to make for more situations where we're in a much more stable regime, where either selling volatility is a good strategy or buying volatility is a good strategy. And we remain in that regime until we shift out of it. And then if you were in a selling volatility regime, the market shifts, all of a sudden you'll have a period where buying volatility virtually at any price is a very lucrative strategy up until the point where the regime shifts. So where it tended to be more two-way in terms of the ways that you would take risk, I think now it's you tend to be in either one regime or the other, and we tend to transition from one regime to the next very quickly.
When you look at the screens these days, if you see something more than a penny wide, you're kind of disappointed. But back in the day, maybe 15, 20 years ago, you'd be a hero on the sell side to make a two-way to a client to be 10 cents or even 15 cents wide. And as you note, it's just electronic liquidity provision at this juncture, and a lot of it is might be thin, but it's tight in terms of bid offer. What are the implications of that, that kind of change to almost more of a stock trading environment where you're doing these little orders at a time rather than big block trades? What are the implications both as a user of derivatives, someone who kind of wakes up every day looking to trade them, and then just on the market making side as spreads have tightened? Give us a sense to how this game of survival has forced people to change how they provide liquidity.
Well, on balance, I would say for the users of options, this shift to the very tight, algorithmically driven markets has really been beneficial for the typical user. And the reason I say that is that somebody who's not a market impact trader, you're just getting tighter prices. In some sense, it's those for a significant subset of the people in the market, those penny wide or two penny wide prices that you see on the screen, particularly in the short end of the curve and some of these more liquid products, like those are real. You can transact significant volumes in those. So I think for the kind of median user of options, it's been beneficial. I would say for somebody who's a market impact trader or larger, it's been detrimental in the sense that I think those very tight quotes are good up to a certain point, but in many cases, it's a little bit hollow behind in the sense that if you do want to get a significant amount of risk that outstrips the ability of those algorithmic systems to deliver it, you really hit a liquidity vacuum very quickly. And part of that is really deliberate on the part of the people that are designing these algorithms. They're designed to capture a little bit of edge a lot of the time, but to get out of the way really quickly when anything seems amiss, whether it's a large order in the marketplace or a broader systematic spike in volatility. And I think that's when I alluded to these very rapid regime shifts from a low volatility regime to a high volatility regime. I think it's that it's the behavior of the algorithms that is, I wouldn't call it the definitive factor in those rapid regime shifts, but it's certainly a powerful contributor.
That's a really interesting point. And I think perhaps as we get into the call, we can talk a little bit about the vol event that is 2020, because it was just so historic on the equity side, the VIX making a new all-time high. I'm just curious if we could talk a little bit further about relative value relationships. We can look at, I mentioned Intel before, maybe it's Intel vol versus Texas Instruments vol, or single stock vol versus index vol, or even within a specific product along the curve, along the surface. And as we're saying, these bid offers are so tight right now. What has it done over the years, just in terms of the relative opportunity set for the folks that are trying to make money, not directionally, but to be agnostic to direction and try to, I would say, arbitrage the properties of different options or different relationships? How has that game changed over time as these screens have tightened so much?
I guess what I would say is it's been a bit of a pendulum. And when we started down this path of large-scale, algorithmically driven liquidity, I would say the early stages of it were really detrimental to the relative value trader in options. In fact, I would say detrimental to the relative value trader in lots of things, even something as simple as long-short equities, simply because for many of the, to implement certain types of relative value strategies, the computer's a lot better at it. It's better at finding them and it's better at implementing them than the average person is. So for a given pool of capital, you can manage risk a lot more efficiently and add and subtract fit risk a lot more efficiently using algorithms, whether it's on the back of a market making business, but you're taking you have some algorithms to take a view, or if you're a proprietary trader. It's just a lot easier to put risk on, and it's a lot easier to kind of to be able to deploy capital on a large scale. So in that sense, I think it initially degraded the opportunity subset simply because it was so much more efficient to put on these types of trades. I think in many ways, the pendulum has really sort of started to swing back in the other direction, in the sense that as you saw this amazing concentration of the liquidity providing into a very narrow number of hands, and coupled with that, the exodus of what I would call the traditional proprietary traders in the option world, who tended to really be affiliated with banks rather than more traditional market makers, what you really saw, and I think this really started in the aftermath of 2008, when they really took regulatory steps to limit proprietary trading within banks. The impact of that, if anything, I would say has accelerated, because you had this removal of relative value trading capacity from the banks. But then in addition to that, I think under normal circumstances, I would think that the buy side would step in and start to provide those same sorts of services, so to speak, to enforce some of these relationships. But I think, unlike many other asset classes where you would tend to see private capital or investment capital flow in, the comfort level for the average institutional allocator in like a relative value option strategy tends to be very, very, very low. So as a consequence, I think the complexity level of those types of trades has been a real deterrent to having an influx of capital to replace this capital that left in the form of banks pulling out of the market and a reduction in the number of market makers. And as a consequence, the pendulum started to swing in the other direction, where you're starting to see these really what I would call traditional relative value relationships open up into a great opportunity subset. And there's not a lot of competition to pursue those types of risks. So in that sense, I think over the next decade, we're going to see a real renaissance of what I would call kind of arbitrage and relative value trading within volatility space.
One thing that you've pointed out is that there's just and certainly this, you can see it, is the concentration of customer order flow moving more towards index and ETF products away from single stock products. I mean, you go down to the floor of the CBO, there's not a single stock pick left, really. But there are more ETFs now than singles, and many of them don't have any liquidity, but many of them do. I'm curious if you can just share with us some of your thoughts about the ETF business as it relates to options, perhaps as it relates to correlations. There's obviously a basket hedge that needs to be done each time. There's a fair amount of debate around ETFs and the impact on stock correlation. But what are your big picture thoughts on just the ETF business as it relates to options, volatility, and correlation?
On balance, I personally think the ETF business has been very healthy. And the reason is that I think because if you think about the primary uses of options for what I would call like the typical strategies, it's basically people either hedging. There are lots of people doing other things, but that's certainly each of those represents a significant portion of the option market. So I say that I view this shift to ETFs as positive because in the case of hedging, the opportunities to very precisely tailor a hedge to exactly the risk that you're concerned about are better than ever. And the fact that the liquidity in these ETFs, the option liquidity in these ETFs, tends to be quite good, at least a fair point in typical market environments, it really, if you're a hedger, it's the golden age, because where before you'd have to use like a dirty hedge in the sense that you're using something like S&P 500 to hedge lots of things, where the reality is your risk might not look much at all like the S&P 500. Whereas now, down to a very granular, almost subsector level, you can implement these very precise hedges if you're interested in doing that. So in that sense, I think it's been a tremendous boon for the hedging strategies. I would say the same thing with the overwriting strategies, simply because when you're an overwriter and you hold an ETF and you overwrite it, you are explicitly and implicitly short correlation. And generally speaking, implied correlation in the option market tends to be too high. And therefore, on balance, even though there are lots of single stock overwriting strategies out there, I think the majority of the time, and certainly in the correlation regime that we've been in, let's say for the past year or so, selling index options is a much more attractive proposition than selling single stock options. So I think it's a boon for the hedger in the sense that they can really tailor their hedges with precision, but it's also a boon for any sort of option writing or premium capture strategy, because the liquidity to be able to implement these things in a more diverse group of markets to give yourself diversification, but still capturing the fact that those index level and sector level option premiums tend to be relatively richer than their single stock equivalent, should give those strategies a little bit of extra edge. So I'm personally a big proponent of this shift to ETFs. So I think it's been beneficial.
The degree to which the trade can be customized and the extent to which the underlying can be chosen to be really consistent with what you're trying to hedge, I think that's a great point. I might add to that, and I'd be curious to get your take on this, is the number of expirations is at an all-time high too. There are options expiring just about every day. Certainly couldn't happen without massive amounts of technology and speed in terms of market data. But there's so much choice. And on balance, the weighted average maturity of options trades has just been a one-way decline to shorter and shorter dated options. I was doing a podcast with a guest, Josh Younger, who runs rate derivative strategy at JP Morgan. And he was like this, he was differentiating the market between gamma and vega. And he said, we think about gamma as anything less than a year. And I almost dropped my coffee because for us, gamma is like less than a week, I suppose. What's your thought on just the proliferation of expirations? What does it mean for the risk profile of the market? And maybe perhaps bring in some insights for us on just also the advent or the re-advent of the retail trader in options. Seems like a active part of the market as well, the retail side.
Those are two very different questions. This huge influx of expirations, definitely from the hedger's perspective, I would call it a little bit of a blessing and a curse for the typical user of options in like a hedging context, in the sense that in my experience, the shorter day of the option, the more overpriced it tends to be. Part of the reason for that is really just the behavioral bias that people like to spend the minimum amount of premium possible. And very short dated options optically look quote unquote cheap because the premiums are low. And as a consequence, I think in many cases, we're seeing more and more hedging activity, particularly tactical hedging activity, shift into kind of premium buying strategies with extremely short maturities. And I think that's probably a little more negative expectation sometimes than longer dated hedges, even though you're spending a lot more premium. So I would say it's a little bit of where ostensibly it gives you the ability to really precisely time your hedges around something like an election or an earnings event in the case of a single stock. It should be advantageous, but I think in practice, there seem to be these behavioral biases that cause people to kind of pay the wrong price for some of these off the run expiries. And it gives them the more expiries, the more opportunities there are to pay the wrong price, I guess is what I would say. Certainly the general trend towards shorter expirations, there's no question. I mean, back for a long time, from 2002 to 2009, I ran a large derivatives book at a big hedge fund. And we did lots of dispersion and correlation trades where at the time I would guess like the weighted average maturity of my option portfolio in any given time was typically around 2 years. It was like really quite a long dated, long maturity relative value book. When you fast forwarded to like 2012, 2013, in many cases, I was deploying almost very similar strategies from a risk perspective in the sense that I was taking correlation risk, basically risk between the price of index options and the price of single stock options. But at that point, my weighted average maturity had dropped from 2 years to like 40 days. So, I mean, really just a huge shift in terms of where I was taking my risk from a maturity perspective. And I think there are really two things at work there. One is that traditionally those longer date option markets tended to have a very heavy over-the-counter presence, where if you want to trade long date options, in many cases, you were doing it over-the-counter. The exodus of the banks from the over-the-counter derivatives market generally has really kind of put paid to this idea that you can trade longer dated hedges and get the same sorts of liquidity either getting into the trade or getting out of the trade that you once enjoyed back in 2005, 2006, 2007. So I think in some ways, as the liquidity providers on the long end of the curve pulled out, that's really sort of driven people shorter. And then this advent of like really short date expirations has exacerbated it. So there's no question it's a trend. I think it's for the end user, it depends on the skill of the end user. And if the end user understands how to think about expiries correctly, then I think it's a real benefit. But it certainly creates more opportunities for a less sophisticated user to make mistakes. As far as this more recent shift, and I view it as something that if I had to flag one of the most interesting things that's happened in 2020, it's really been this renaissance of single stock option trading. And to me, it is a little bit reminiscent of 1999, 2000, as we were kind of going into the meat of the tech bubble. So I'm actually really interested to see how it plays out. My sense is that there's a much bigger scale of retail participation in single stock options than there's been in decades. And I think it'll make for some very good things, actually, going forward to the extent that it's sustained.
I love looking at the Tesla vol skew. You've got this company that's got a $600 billion market cap, and its vol skew is completely upward sloping to the call, reminiscent of those days in 99 and 2000. You were referring to your days running some dispersion and correlation strategies. And in addition to overseeing more carry generating strategies, you've also done a bunch on the tail risk hedging side. We've seen these periods of just impossibly low vol and impossibly high vol. 2017, we realized 6.5 for the entire year. 2020, we realized 170 for 5 days when you incorporate those 9% moves over a couple of days. What does it tell you, perhaps, about market structure? And how should people think about tail risk hedging when we know that the bleed for long, long periods of time can almost be intolerably high? And yet, it seems like it can be quite important to have on during dark days of a crisis.
The scale of the shift that you're talking about from these ultra low vol environments to these ultra high vol environments, I believe, although it's very difficult to verify, but I believe that the root cause of it really is in this concentration of market making liquidity into a relatively small number of firms with relatively less capital committed to the space, certainly than we saw a decade ago or two decades ago. And the way that those systems are really, as I alluded to earlier, explicitly designed is that when things start to get volatile, their capital base doesn't necessarily scale with the volatility. It doesn't scale with necessarily an increase in volume, at least on a day-by-day basis, it doesn't. And as a consequence, what these systems are designed to do is that if it looks like you're going to be trading more, being forced to warehouse a little bit more risk, you have to widen your markets out and take more edge in order to justify that. And to be able to, because you're basically having to like take more risk, and as a consequence, you've got to get more edge in order for it to be effective. So where previously, I think that probably happened on some level where a bank trader would definitely be a little bit more reluctant to make a big market. At the same time, he was under a lot of pressure from the sales guys to make good tight markets to customers. So there was this bank reputation factor that would really kind of constrain that to some extent. Whereas now there's no algorithmic engine out there that's concerned about its reputation. They're simply trying to kind of maximize their risk-adjusted returns. And if you look at the, from what I understand, the Sharpe ratios that you see in these market making systems, just on a kind of gross P&L basis, it's like a 5 Sharpe or a 6 Sharpe or like something on that scale. These things are extremely, extremely predictable and efficient. And as a consequence, they're not really incentivized to just go out on a limb and take extra risk when they're generating such high performance per dollar committed to the market making business. I think it's the market making systems backing up. They're really severely exacerbating these vol spikes. Because that happens so much more quickly now than it did, it's made hedging more important in the sense that this idea that you can wait for trouble to show up and then go out and implement your hedge, as you really could do for a long time. I mean, even if you think back to 2008, things went berserk in the late fall, early winter of 2008. But in mid-summer 2008, at one point you could buy vol at like sub 20, if I recall, in the S&P 500. And that was after you'd already seen a bunch of bankruptcies in mortgage space, you'd see implosion at the mortgage market. And yet there was this sort of lull where you had an opportunity to reset your hedges if you needed them. That regime where you have these slower moving crises that you can kind of wait until you see the whites of their proverbial eyes before hedging, that regime appears to be gone in large part, I think, because of the way that these liquidity systems respond to any sort of volatility. And as a consequence, it makes hedging more important because the scale of these volatility events is much bigger, but also makes it much harder because timing is very difficult to figure out. In the windows in which you have, whether it's to put on hedges or to monetize hedges, are narrower than they've ever been. So I think it makes hedging more important because the volatility events are bigger, but it's also a lot harder because things move so much more quickly now that if you don't have your plan in place to implement your hedges or take off your hedges under very specific circumstances, you have to be thinking about it and figuring it out during the event. You're just going to be too late and you're going to be offsides the whole time.
This tail risk question came into very public debate in and around March when I think it was CalPERS, turns out, had fired Universa about 2 months too early. And while they kept one tail risk manager on, they did not have the protection that Universa was providing and cost them a pile of money. And so there was a lot of back and forth just around the concept of tail risk hedging. Is it worth it over time? We know that there's an observable vol risk premium, at least in the data that we can look at. And one of my favorite charts, no conversation with you would be complete without getting your assessment of the Volmageddon in early 18. One of my favorite charts is if you do a graph of both the TVIX and the XIV, so the two times long and the two times short, they both went bankrupt, which I find so fascinating. And one did it all at once, and then one did it over many, many years. What's your take just in terms of, you know, you got to take risks to make money. You have to find yourself trying to generate carry. But we know that these vol blowups happen with some degree of frequency. What's your big picture take on just how to think about incorporating tail risk into a portfolio?
I think very complicated question. I would have a couple comments. The first is that, and I managed a tail risk fund in conjunction with a credit team for a number of years, dedicated tail risk fund. And oftentimes when we'd meet with prospective investors, what we would tell them is that generally speaking, tail hedging is negative expectation over time. If you invest a dollar in tail hedging and you leave it there long enough, it's probably going to disappear. It's almost certainly going to disappear. However, that doesn't make tail risk hedging negative expectation. And here's why. Because if you have what you perceive to be, for example, a portfolio that you think is going to return 15%, if I offered you the opportunity to hedge out all the downside in that portfolio for 2%, you should do that day in and day out. Because with the portfolio plus the hedge, you're essentially going to be guaranteed a 13% return. So if you had a situation where you had a perfect inexpensive hedge that you're pairing with a risk asset that you believe to be high performance, then the best hedging can be a spectacularly value add proposition on a risk adjusted basis. So the first thing that you have to do before you even think about tail hedging is look at the actual portfolio that you're trying to hedge and decide, does it make sense to hedge it? Does it seem like there's enough performance expected to justify what really probably will be a cost associated with that hedging? And if the answer that you come up with is that there's not enough edge in this portfolio to hedge, in some cases that might be because hedging is really expensive, like the price of options is really high. In some cases, it might be an indicator that you should sell down that portfolio and take some risk off. In other words, there are two different ways you can hedge. One is to set up a sub-portfolio that hedges your primary portfolio. And the second is to simply take off the risk that you actually got on. In my experience, that second option, just taking off the risk, is something that many people, whether they're individuals or institutional investors or endowments or pension funds, they don't like to take their core risks off. They're not willing to just put money in cash at this point. And I think in many cases, that's oftentimes the best thing they can do rather than investing in a tail hedging strategy, but they're not willing to do it for all sorts of different reasons. So that's the first question. It's like, should you just take off your primary risk rather than trying to use a tail hedge? The second point is that in tail hedging, there's this sort of interplay between what I would call complexity and performance in tail hedging. Generally speaking, the more precisely you can design a hedge and the more complex you can make the hedge in the sense that you devolve to, if you go from indices to single stocks, for example, or if you go from indices to even sectors in some cases, you're essentially going to see a situation where you oftentimes can come up with some very explicit calculations in terms of like how much convexity you're able to buy for a given price and how much basis risk does it entail relative to the portfolio that you're hedging. Once you decide whether or not you should hedge, if you decide, yes, I want to keep this risk on and hedge it, doing a very explicit analysis of that basis risk versus expected hedge performance trade-off is the next most important thing. Many people devolve to these very simplistic hedging strategies, which are sort of the worst of all worlds. They're relatively poor expected performance in a disaster relative to the amount of money that you're spending for the hedge. And in many cases, you're taking basis risk to boot. If you're using S&P 500 to hedge a technology stock portfolio, as we've seen over the past year where there's been this massive tech versus old economy divergence, you can really create some complicated situations for yourself as you see the performance of the hedge instrument in the primary portfolio diverge. So really explicitly thinking about those relationships, I think, is crucial. And the third thing is that because the new market regime forces you to make decisions so quickly, you really need to, in my opinion, come up with a very discrete framework in terms of how you're going to manage the hedge going forward so that you can respond quickly to market circumstances. So to me, if you're looking to really hedge effectively, those are the three big things. Decide whether hedging makes sense and do it in a really quantitatively intelligent fashion. Then make an explicit assessment of how much basis risk you're willing to take and the relative convexity that you're going to be able to buy yourself per hedge dollar at each different level of basis risk. And then the next thing is come up with a plan in advance to manage that hedge. And your comment about CalPERS, they clearly were doing it ad hoc. They just said, hey, this seems like a good time to take off the hedge. And it's possible that they were doing it systematically and they replaced it and that wasn't reported. But essentially, when you start to introduce this kind of discretionary component into things, there's definitely room for error. And in that case, the error appears to have been costly.
Let's finish off with a couple things. One, I want to circle back to your comment on single stock vol, because I know you're doing a lot in that space. But before that, let's just start with the index side, your assessment of the big structure of the S&P 500, especially the term structure. I'm curious, as you stare at VIX futures or the term structure of S&P vol, I know out to May and June, I think VIX futures are still north of 25. It's maybe even closer to 26. We're realizing about 12 vol on the S&P. What's your take on just the pricing of equity vol? There's certainly been a fair amount of ink spilled on equity vol versus credit spreads or equity vol versus the MOVE index, pointing to one being higher than the other. Equities just kind of standing out as too high. Are you in that camp, or how do you see just the broad pricing of equity optionality in the S&P?
Generally speaking, equity vol looks somewhat high to me at almost every curve point. It doesn't look radically high to me, but I would also say that many other non-equity products, if you look at rate vol, if you look at certain other vol and FX I track less closely, but certainly if you look at vol and credit spreads in the over-the-counter market, or just looking at the volatility on ETFs like HYG or LQD, also quite expensive. So I would say equity vol is elevated, but most vols are elevated right now. I'm a little bit surprised by it because I expected a bit more contraction post-election, and we haven't seen that. What makes equity vol a little unique, and this is where things get I would say more interesting, is where some of these other markets, I think you have this real possibility for volatility collapse, in the sense that whether it's corporate credit spreads or interest rates, you have the Federal Reserve really actively trying to control those markets. But those are markets that are inherently negatively convex, in the sense that if you don't believe the Federal Reserve is going to take rates negative, if you don't think the Federal Reserve is going to buy corporate credit beyond a certain point, you have a situation where they can't necessarily go down that much, but they can't necessarily go up that much either, because credit spreads are close to some of the tightest levels we've seen in a long time, and interest rates are at some of the lowest levels we've seen in a long time. So you have a situation where it seems like those assets have to be somewhat range-bound. Equities are a more complicated proposition, in the sense that if, in the hypothetical, we had a replay of the tech bubble, if you looked at what characterized the tech bubble as an option trader, it was characterized by rising valuations, particularly in tech stocks, coupled with rising volatility. It was an equity up, vol up market. And if we saw a replay of that, then in that context, equity vol doesn't look crazy, because equity vol, if you can have a situation where the asset's rallying and the rally is unconstrained, as we saw tech stock rallies could be back in the tech bubble, then in some sense, there's a rational component to having equity vol high, because there's this unbounded upside that could be very explosive. I'm not sure I 100% buy that idea, but I think that's the kind of bullish argument for equity vol. And as a consequence, while it looks high to me, I'm not sure it's something that I would want to wager on aggressively at this point.
One of the characteristics of 2020 equity vol, let's say post-pandemic, because you've had some pretty big moves. June 11th, down 6%. Of course, I want to say September 3rd, and then maybe the 6th in the Qs, we were down 5% days. So some big moves. And a lot of these moves are from stocks with absolutely no default risk. Pristine balance sheets, Amazon, Apple, Facebook. These are 40 vol stocks with hundreds of billions of dollars of cash. So in some ways, that divergence between equity vol and pretty thin credit spreads, I think it's explainable to some extent, just in terms of the way in which stocks are moving around. It's not default risk. It's really just positioning, and the momentum trade goes a little too far. So it's fascinating. And so on the single stock side, just to wrap up, because I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, as you call it, renaissance of single stock trading. What are you seeing there? What kind of opportunities are you excited about? Be great to get your take on that.
First, I'd like to see the fact that people are participating in the market, not as some guy sitting and just overriding every single stock in his portfolio blindly, but actually really looking and saying, hey, what's going to happen with this specific stock on this specific day? I think it makes for a much more opportunistic market, in the sense that there are lots of different ways. The more participants you have, the more likely it is that things dislocate to the point where you can, whether it's as a hedger being able to buy really cheap hedges, or as a speculator really trying to find ways to exploit mispricing in the derivatives market, it has the potential to just provide a lot of opportunity. And I think we're seeing that in certain facets of the market, whether it's, you point out Tesla as an example. I think Tesla has this massive market cap, and yet, I'm not sure how many people realize, but Tesla is actually a high yield borrower. It's actually a member of the CDX high yield index. So on one hand, you have this one of the biggest market cap companies in the world that borrows money at high yield rates. It's odd and interesting. And to me, when you see things like that, just that dislocation between what the credit market's perception of the creditworthiness of a company is versus the equity market's perception of the valuation, that's the kind of market that to me tends to engender significant opportunities. So certainly opportunity subset going forward, very bullish. I think in addition to that, it's this basic concept of trying to price events in these names, which are becoming increasingly volatile. There's a lot of opportunity there. But more generally, if you looked, for example, as I mentioned, as we discussed, I trade correlation strategies for a long time in various capacities. And if you looked at the single greatest period to be short correlation, it was actually during the tech bubble, because you had this confluence of high volatility a low correlation. And it's entirely possible we're headed in that direction. And part of the reason for that actually has to do with the way that this rally in tech stocks relative to everything else in equity space has shifted the sector distribution within the index. So I think at this point, I mean, last I checked, we're at a point where tech stocks are over 30% of the index at this point and exhibiting justifiably relatively little correlation to the other stocks in the index, particularly on the upside, because people's perception is that value doesn't matter. And as a consequence, there's no price that's too high to pay for a hot tech stock. So when you have the possibility for volatility on both the upside and the downside, it really allows those stocks to disconnect from the broader market, and that drives down correlation. So that has implications, obviously, if you're a correlation trader. It also has implications if you're a hedger, in the sense that when you have a relatively lower correlation market, where tech stocks are doing their own thing, completely separate from the old economy stocks, that tends to reduce volatility at the index level, because on some days they're going to move in opposite directions. And as a consequence, it makes it much, generally speaking, hedging strategies that are more effective in a market like that tend to be either focused on individual single stocks, like you buy puts on the single stocks that you want to hedge, or you're better off using sector hedges, because that's where the volatility is. The volatility is at the sector level, the volatility is at the single stock level. So as a relative value trader, it definitely, I would say, you should be upvaluing single stock optionality and downvaluing index optionality. But in addition to that, even the hedgers can benefit from that by really using sector hedges at the appropriate times when they can, because if we go into a low correlation sort of 2000 to 2002 style regime, those were really the types of hedges and the types of strategies that worked during that period.
Last topic, love to just hear, I know you're active in the SPAC market. What can you share with us just about the current state of that market, the sort of characteristics of how SPACs are issued, how they trade, some of the derivative implications? I know you're doing a lot there. Tell us what you're up to.
As somebody who's traded a variety of products over a fairly long career, it reminds me a little bit of the early days of the convertible bond market, or actually even the early days of the option market, where you had situations where something as simple as reverse conversions into a tender or something like that were just mispriced. That's really what the SPAC market looks like. And to some extent, the odd characteristics of the market and the sort of underdeveloped aspects of the market are really a function of how quickly it's grown. This year, SPAC issuance, last I looked, was around $70 billion, where if you went back like 5 years ago, it was like single-digit billions. So literally, it's grown almost 20-fold in 5 years. And when you have this massive influx of issuance, and for those who aren't aware, typically when a SPAC is issued, they issue a relatively long-dated warrant as part of the SPAC issuance. So as a derivative arbitrageur, when you have a combination of a company that is essentially an option in and of itself, because they hold a portfolio of treasuries, and really when you own the equity, what you own is this portfolio of treasuries plus a call option on the asset that they might ultimately purchase. But then in addition to that, you have warrants on that, what is, because the company itself is essentially a derivative instrument, when you look at these warrants, they are compound derivatives, in my opinion. And in addition, you have complicated borrower issues and understanding what are the mergers go through and trying to price what the post-merger volatility is going to be like. There are a lot of moving parts. And I think it's really a market where there are some spectacular opportunities right now, and there are going to be some spectacular opportunities in the near term, because we continue to see just a flood of capital into it. And in many cases, at least to my eye, the investor base is surprisingly unsophisticated. That's not to say that there aren't sophisticated people out there trading in the SPAC market, but there are also a lot of very unsophisticated people, both retail and institutional. And I think that it makes for a pretty amazing opportunity subset. I mean, today happened to be a day where there were just some crazy moves in the SPAC market, despite virtually nothing going on in the broader market. So it also has that characteristic where it appears that SPAC market risk is diverging from, or at least orthogonal to, what's going on in the mainline equity market, at least some of the time.
John Mark, we covered a lot of ground here, in under an hour. I appreciate your time. It was great to connect, and our viewers will value this conversation. Thanks again.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
You've been listening to the Alpha Exchange. If you've enjoyed the show, please do tell a friend. And before we leave, I wanted to invite you to drop us some feedback. As we aim to utilize these conversations to contribute to the investment community's understanding of risk, your input is valuable and provides direction on where we should focus. Please email us at feedback@alphaexchangepodcast.com. Thanks again, and catch you next time.